Welcome once again to another fantastic episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. We help business creators like you win at the game of business and marketing so you can thrive from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion and make a difference for your community, market, and audience. Please take a moment and visit our website, www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. You'll find hundreds of episodes covering a breadth and depth of topics relevant to you as a business creator, and links to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. And now, here's today's episode. Let's get started.
My name is Adam Homey. I'm your host. I am honored once again by your wise decision to
check out our previous and upcoming episodes on our website at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com.
We have those mastermind
meetings. While you're there, be sure to subscribe via your favorite
network
to get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. Until next time, have a great day.
Take care. Today, I come to you from the balcony of my sumptuous apartment here in beautiful Las Vegas, Nevada, known to some as the hottest city in America. And we are going to have an enervating conversation on leadership strategy and management strategy. Now, this is going to be a very, very in-depth conversation. I suspect it's going to go in a few different directions as a true mastermind meeting conversation actually does. So I invite you as a listener to take out a pad of paper and have two pens ready. And I say two pens because you know that one will break or one will run out of ink or your cat will grab it and run off with it. And that way you don't want to be without your pen. Just as you're getting that nugget of wisdom that's going to change something for you or solve some question you didn't even know a few moments ago to ask to resolve a situation or to gain a benefit that you've been searching for some time. So with us today is Don Schminka, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about him. He's the author of the best-selling book, The Code of Executive, and he's been featured in the Wall Street Journal and USA Today. He's an award-winning speaker, researcher, founder of the SAGA Leadership Institute, and he's delivered over 1,700 speeches, all of which was a warm-up for him appearing on the Business Creators Radio Show. Don Schminka, come on in. The weather's fine.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right. I read off your official bio and just those couple sentences. There's so much credentialization there. I'm not sure I'm worthy to be in your presence. And this is my show. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to, before we dive into the topics that you're going to share with us, is peel open the curtain and have you tell us a bit about your journey and how it's brought you to where you are today, serving from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion.
It's a interesting background. I mean, yeah, I almost dropped out of high school and I didn't really have any, I was a little confused about, you know, where I wanted to go, but I ended up at a community college, cause I was in rock bands and working at my uncle's gas station, and a couple people there noticed something about me. I don't know what they saw, but one thing led to another. I went through a battery of tests. They asked me to apply to MIT and I didn't know what that was. And so I went through a number of grueling things, but I got accepted. And that's what took me into all new world. And I started applying myself in the early stages of just learning AI back in the 70s to electrical engineering and planetary physics. And so I got involved in, and I did my thesis with Harvard MIT Biomedical Laboratory that automated. But that's when I started studying humans, and that's what took me. I left MIT, went to Hopkins, did my graduate work there, and then I began studying or teaching actually in the executive MBA program at Johns Hopkins back in the day. And that's what took me into looking at how leaders perform and businesses grow, which I didn't know anything about, but I did know something about people were complaining about the failure rates of management theory. And that's what got me in touch with Oxford University and getting permission to use an ancient manuscript I had come about on. I was doing a lot of expeditionary research, different parts of the world at the time, to sort of test certain theories and do some filming and interviewing. And this ancient manuscript emerged, and they had a professor, Al Sadler, at University of Australia, had left his legacy and his his work to Oxford, which of course gave me permission to use it. That's how it came about. So I wrote that, and then I wrote some other books after that. But I started getting consumed by the challenge of entrepreneurs and CEOs and leaders. And so I guess I ended up, somebody told me the other day, I've trained about 30,000 CEOs. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. They said, yeah, you've been doing this a long time. So I said, okay, I got that. So I got a new book coming out in the fall called Winners and Losers. That's really focused just on entrepreneurs to try to pull together all this research that's based in anthropology and evolutionary genetics, and then test it with some of the largest and smallest companies in over 100 industries. So that's how I got here. And so between the writing and the teaching, by teaching, I mean doing speeches and workshops, and I'm starting to get into blogging and maybe even doing my own podcast series so I can be as successful as you and try to get this word out.
Well, you are in the right place for podcasting, but let's put a bookmark in that. And what I want to, I'm really curious about this research. I mean, one of my avocations is neuroscience. I love the intricacies of how the brain works. I've made some amazing discoveries through being a recipient of hypnotherapy. I mean, I heard all my life that the most powerful computer that will ever develop is the one between the two human ears. And my research and my experiences have taught me that that is really indeed the case. We have powers, reserve powers, that we don't even know are there. So when I hear about research, this is one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, because I know you did a very significant research project, and I think we'll start there. So what was that pivotal moment when you realized, Don, that something was missing that needed to be addressed within leadership development?
Well, as I began pulling together executive groups, and some of these were in membership organizations, associations, and some were just companies where I went in, they brought me in, and I worked with their executive teams, is they all started talking about the same issues. And some issues were more important than others, depending on the decade. But, you know, it's always around people issues or marketplace issues, branding, competition. How are we doing? Are we growing? And so there, a lot of this I found out, even though the shock was when I went back to look at what they were reading, I found out that there were 35,000 business books published annually, and no one had told them that. And I'm like, why has no one told you this before? I say, you publish more than cancer research, but at least we're making progress in cancer research. You're still dealing with issues that are shared around the world. But then the Oxford, when I started using the ancient samurai training manuals for training managers, and that's when I published the Code of the Executive, I saw the same issues they were dealing with. So this opened up a whole new world, thinking like, well, how old are these issues? So we went back even further, and we found out that the more we went back, the more they were the same. In other words, you know, you go back to Alexander or Caesar or Genghis Khan, and you know, you find that, wait a minute, we're dealing with the same stuff, but for some reason, we've got 35,000 books a year, and it's still the same problems exist. So what are we missing? And that's what really took us on a journey to discover a new model of leadership that if we could test it and it worked, we knew we were onto something. So we began testing it, and companies started growing 2 to 3 times faster, in some cases 10 times their size. And that's when we knew that we had, you know, had stumbled onto something that, you know, has been known for thousands of years, but for some reason we just forget to teach it or write about it.
Yeah, one of my things I really love studying is autobiographies, because theory is great, but I love to see how people who have dealt with actual situations have proceeded on that and what guided them to do it and what the results they got were and how they reacted to that. To me, experience is one of the best teachers of all, and the second best way to do it, in my view, is to put yourself looking through the eyes of somebody else and seeing their experiences. So I think one of the things that we see over and over again, and you were very macro there, I'm going to bring this down to micro, is how we assess leadership and management. And we continue to have this model where we see that people get promoted into management positions based on how they performed in their subordinate position, which did not involve management. So you may be a salesperson and you consistently run head and shoulders above the best numbers for a year. So they say, okay, congratulations, you're a sales manager now. All right. Well, I can tell you a real story about that. A friend of mine who's been in car sales for 30 years, it's the only thing he's ever done. Even in high school, he was selling cars. I mean, you mentioned the looking for a direction in high school. I think he was about his junior year. He already had his direction. He was officially a detailer, but he was also selling. And today he's a sales manager for a dealership and he does very well with it. But the first couple times, and I'm saying this the way I'm saying it, the first couple times he was promoted into management positions, he was barely there a week before he begged to be put back on the floor. Mm-hmm. And what it came down to is a combination of two things, which I couldn't articulate at the time, and I'm not sure he could either, because he and I just didn't really get all that deeply into it. But I think it was a realization that where he was in his own journey, management was not the intersection of his brilliance and his passion. And number two, at least a tacit recognition that his brilliance on the sales floor had not yet reached the point where it translated into leading others to achieve the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a gap there. And I think you see it as well as I do, as do our listeners, is, okay, so the guy did really, really well on the sales floor. Well, he deserves the management position. We got to promote this guy. But is he the right person to manage? And even if he is he prepared to manage?
Yeah.
And I think that's a gap that you want to talk about the diminishing returns of repeated actions. That's a classic right there.
Yeah, we've run into that many times, as I'm sure you have too. An executive is dysfunctioning, and then you ask the CEO, "How did they get their role?" And it's, well, because they were really good at what they did before I promoted them. Uh-huh. And so there really are two different worlds. And I admire him for wanting to get back to what he did well, because I think we get seduced by our beliefs that taking on leadership roles is just an advancement of what we're already doing well, when it's not necessarily the case. And in fact, I was starting my blog. I just got into this because I had some CEOs say, "God, can you bust some more myths?" Because, you know, yeah. I spent a workshop busting myths all over the place. So my latest one that came out last week was on lead dogs. And because everybody's like, you've heard all the saying, you know, you got to be the lead dog or the review never changes, or uh-huh. That's somebody's butt. And it's this belief that we have to move up to be better or to be important. And at the end of the day, I think it's just all bullshit. I mean, you know, and I went through looking at some of these authors and speakers and consultants, and I found that none of them ran a dog sled team. And so I'm like, how can you talk about lead dogs when you've never seen a lead dog? So anyway, I then got into the work we had done running dog sled teams, because it's something that I fell into. I'm not real professional at it, but whenever I'm out in the mountains and there's a dog sled area, I'll see, hey, can I come by and run some sleds? And it's interesting because the dogs that had the hardest time are the lead dogs.
Yeah.
And the dogs behind them aren't standing at their ass. They're not doing that. They're looking to the sides. They're barking at each other. Sometimes they're jumping the line. Like in one case where two dogs jumped the line to the other side, team became unbalanced and the sled starts going off into deep snow in a ravine, you know, and it's just and the poor lead dogs are trying to keep everybody on the trail. Meanwhile, the sled's gone off. I'm standing on the snow break, but the snow's too soft. It's too deep. It's not working. And then I realized this thing's going to tip. So my son's at, might have 5-year-old son inside. Right. And, mm-hmm. I leap to the outer, which we're trained to do, the outer rung and the outer rail. And I leaned back you know, like you're doing in sailboat racing or racing a catamaran, to keep it on before a snowboat would be able to catch up and halt the team. So the poor lead dogs, I mean, they were just having a hard time. They couldn't get this thing going the way it should have went. And I see this in organizations, that leadership. In fact, when I wrote the book, High Altitude Leadership, with Chris Warner. Now, you know, he's like the top rescue climber in the world. And I met him climbing in the Andes. So we wrote this book together, High Altitude Leadership. And we start off with, you know, leadership sucks. And I had a good laboratory through him because he was going to do the K2 thing with NBC. So we literally did the book live during the NBC filming for this book. And again, we found the same thing, that, you know, it's tough when you're trying to lead humans to higher levels. And it's not as, you know, sexy and exciting as people think it is. And so I think we need to teach leadership differently. And one of those elements is, why do you want to be a leader? Because it's going to be different and you may hate it. And now if you love it, that's great. But a lot of people get promoted into positions, as you mentioned, that probably shouldn't have been. They should have found other ways to utilize and grow and develop these people to do what they want to do versus have them lead humans. Because leading humans isn't really doing the work you love, unless you love leading humans.
Well, and some people do love leading humans. And to me, and this is a thought that I have, is leading humans is, to me, a key part of leadership, because ultimately it's those humans. And you want to go back to the metaphor of the pack of dogs. If one of those dogs trips, it can cause a chain reaction, and there goes your caravan. Mm-hmm. If one of those dogs just decides to stop running, that can also cause a chain reaction. It can cause all the dogs to trip on each other. It can, if they're harnessed together, it can also cause the other dogs to say, well, this dog's not running, I'm not running either. Why should I bust my tail? And those are things we see in workplaces too. And I myself, during the 5 or 6 years that I was in corporate America and worked in various corporate positions, you know, it got to a point where I showed up ready to do an honest day's work. And I saw these, people mailing it in who had their jobs due to nepotism, and somehow they're getting rewarded and I'm the goat. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean greatest of all time, as in the goat, the one they kick around. Well, at what point do I realize, you know, I'm going to get the same paycheck no matter what I do?
Right.
And we did get to a point, and I covered this in one of my other interviews on this show, when me and my guest delved into the, I'm trying to think which one it was. It'll come to me. But, oh, it was when I interviewed Becca Powers, but I can't remember the name of the episode. But anyway, when somebody goes into quiet quitting mode, they... for a while, you may actually see their performance improve. And this, to me, goes to one of the other fallacies and one of the other errors. Here's why. Because when somebody gets to the point where they're quiet quitting, that means they haven't gotten to the point where they figured out what their next job or their next move is going to be. So they're going to stick around for this paycheck, which means they're going to take some of the pressure off themselves in the meantime. They're not going to innovate. They're not going to buck the system. So now they're not going to be seen as high maintenance or intransigent or not a team player or all the other labels we sometimes stick on people who don't just blindly follow the corporate line. What they'll do is they'll whip out their copy of the job description. They'll go through all the bullet points and they'll say, am I doing this? Yes. Am I doing this? Yes. Am I doing this? No, but it starts today. And then they're going to evaluate everything that they do, every deliverable they turn in, against their job description. Is it fulfilling those bullets? Yes. Is it outside the bullets? Well, if it's outside the bullets, I don't have to do that. It's not my job description. But in the meantime, here's the funny thing. On paper, metrically, it looks like they're improving, because for a while, they've gone from innovating to just simply fulfilling written expectations. So if you want to look at that strictly on spreadsheets and comparing bullet points, it looks like they've gotten more focused, where they finally got disciplined and got their act together and started doing their damn job. Isn't that funny how that works?
Yeah, I think today, what I'm seeing is this during COVID and the remote work and the whole mass resignation thing is there's a shift. Not everyone, but I think about a third of the CEOs are having a hard time finding the great talent
and
keeping it. Because I think a lot of those people that might have quietly quit thought, wait a minute, I can get another job easily. And they don't have to be in the state I'm in. Like, I don't have to move my family. And if there's something more exciting, I can do, I have more opportunities now. So there's good and bad to that. I mean, the good thing is people can explore careers and work elements that previously were barrier restricted. On the other hand, then companies are now realizing, geez, these people left en masse. How long were these just sitting there? And
right.
You got to take the game up a little bit and say, well, why should we work for us? You know, what are we up to? And how do we win? It's one of the things I think is interesting is that whenever we have people coming to us or new clients coming on board, we want to try to find out what does winning mean, or we need to create that meaning. Because if we can't agree on what winning means, nothing else means anything. That includes how we structure, how we develop, who we hire, culture. Because how we're going to win in the marketplace is really the most ancient question. You know, what does winning mean and how are we going to do it? So the people thing, I think, is just an artifact of a number of questions that CEOs and leaders need to be asking. And if we get too focused on the operational urgencies, we miss the big pictures. And that's what I find. A lot of executives get sucked into operations. They start dealing with tactical conflicts. They're wondering why there's so much internal fighting when it's like, look, take a step back, take a breath. What is your strategy? And a lot of times they can't answer the question. Like, we have no idea. I mean, our strategy is to make an extra $2 million next year. That's not a strategy.
That's a goal.
Yeah, it's like
it's a goal, and as I heard you say, it's a score. So we're looking at it's like going into the championship game and saying we're going to score 21 points. But then somebody asks you, well, what are your plays? Have you diagrammed them? How are you, who are your starters? Who are your closers? Who are your reliefs? What particular strengths do your players have? And if you can't answer those questions, you ain't getting those 21.
Yeah, and it's even more basic than that. Do I bring a tennis racket, a football, a bat, or running shoes? I mean, what are we talking about?
And you know, you bring that up, and it may sound like it's in jest, but I can tell you, I've seen with my own eyes, both as working in that world and as being a consultant to that world, that how many times have people brought a tennis racket to a football game?
Yeah.
Or how many people brought a soccer ball to a football game because they didn't check to see which type of football it was.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, with, cause I remember, you know, when I quiet quit back in 2004 in my last job, you know, fast forward like 2 months from there, and man, I was getting praise like, you know, it's so great. You finally got it together. Your numbers are up. Everything seems to be aligned. You're getting it. And I just said, thank you very much. Thank you for your mentorship that helped me get there. They probably didn't see my fingers crossed with the hand I was holding behind my back, because the part I didn't say is, yeah, do you notice I've been showing up exactly on time and leaving exactly on time and taking my full lunch hour? It's because I've already checked out of here. I'm saving my brilliance and passion for my side gig, which I'm looking to jump into full time for the end of the year. I didn't say that part.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I just got myself really familiar with the bullet points they were looking for and made my work conform to it. Now, in the short term, that removed an administrative hassle. In the long term, what did it cost them?
Yeah, I think the leaders who are leading people, if you can't find that out in the people that you're trying to lead, then you're missing, you know, an opportunity.
And, yeah.
It's a journey at leading humans, and it's a lot different than a lot of what we're teaching in their popular business theories. And so that's when we, you know, are looking at taking organizational performance to a new level. It depends on what it means. You know, what does the new level mean? What does winning mean?
Yeah.
And different for each company. And so we try to do a lot of preliminary situational analysis to determine what that is. But at the end of the day, humans aren't following. It's another one of those myths that I have to, we're doing another blog post on.
Yeah.
People follow leaders, and it's not true. When Apple started supporting the innovation research, the creativity, the brain research that my colleague Cameron Logman was pioneering, Steve Jobs had died, and they started writing books and movies about him. And everything they said was he was an asshole.
Yeah.
He was a jerk. He basically violated everything we teach in our business schools about how to be a good manager and leader. And yet, for some reason, he creates the most powerful company in the world. So the question that is never asked, that I think is the only question to ask, is how does a guy who leads like that, who violates everything where we think is great leadership, end up creating a company like that? And that's what took us into a whole nother area of research. So even though Cameron was pioneering this great area about the innovation in the brain, which they needed to find out because what the hell was going on in Steve Jobs' brain.
Yeah.
We realized that wasn't the first event. I mean, through history, and there are a lot of great leaders and great people that have conquered and won and built great companies that were assholes. And I thought, why aren't we teaching this? And then I realized that we're teaching leadership wrong, because leaders and followers never follow leaders. What followers are actually following is what we call the compelling saga. We stole it from the Vikings. You know, the compelling saga, the story the leader represents. And so when I challenge CEOs, like, what's the story? What's the saga that you represent for your people? That's what they're following. And most of them can't answer the question. And so we end up doing some work on how to do that, because it's like, look, until you have a saga, until you have this epic strategic drama, the story that you represent, what are they following? Your personality? And so that really revolutionized a lot of the organizations we've worked with. And I think we should start teaching it that way. So for instance, if your boss had actually had a story, had a some strategic drama that you got consumed with, that you were just hot about winning, then you could have had the conversation like, look, I'm just showing up, and I don't want to just show up. I want to do more of what you're doing or what you're seeing and where you're going. And tell me more about that, because that's the game I'm going to be in. And I'm kind of checked out. And a good leader would say, thank you for bringing that up. Here's exactly what I need you to do. Or here's exactly what's missing for me. And what can we do to fill that? I mean, you would have been teamed up with taking the team, you know, to the next level. As opposed to, I think some supervisors and managers don't even think of asking that question.
All right. Here's and I'm wondering if this is a different way of stating it, but I've given this type of thing a different type of thought. So sometimes I get the opportunity to have my guests tell me if I'm on the right path or not. So Steve Jobs, I remember an anecdote about him, is that he would do some MBWA, which is management by walking around, and he would go up to random people, whether it was developers, whether it was managers, whether it was the people in the mailroom. And he would approach you. It didn't matter if he knew your name or not, because he always had the same question for you. What are you working on?
Mm-hmm.
Woe betide you if you could not tell him what you were working on and how it benefited Apple.
Right.
So what I believe he was doing there is that was his way of testing to see the extent to which the organization was aligned with Apple's goals. And by creating that sense that at any time, Steve Jobs himself could come right up to you and ask you what you're doing, it got you thinking about what you were doing and how you were supporting Apple's mission and how you were understanding Apple's mission. And I think that had something to do without actually having people chant slogans and helping them to really viscerally understand why they were there and what their opportunities were to be of service and to make positive change. Now, here's another thing. I'm a big buff when it comes to United States presidential history. I can't get enough of it. Do not put me on a Wikipedia in front of an article about a president at 10 o'clock at night, because by 6 in the morning, I'll still be going over some of the 27 ancillary browser tabs I've opened. But anyway, there was a book I read, and this is another case where I'm not remembering the title, where they compared they compared the internal leadership styles of some of our recent presidents. I'm going to pull up two examples, actually two, one who succeeded the other, Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. So to keep this brief, Reagan was, contrary to what we know him as the great communicator, as a person was highly introverted, which I can relate to myself. So people in the West Wing, Reagan would occasionally be walking around and you make eye contact with him, he's going to give you a little friendly nod and keep walking. And he probably has no idea who you are. He just assumes if you're there, you probably belong there and his people have it handled. Bush, on the other hand, would stop by your desk, he'd ask you about your family and chat with you about things you enjoy doing. And sometimes he would randomly look up your parents and call them and tell them what a great job you were doing. And when they went and asked some staffers who had worked for both presidents, which one they preferred, they all, I think, except for one or two, chose Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the reason why. With Reagan, let's say he came up to your desk, and every so often he would actually do this, he'd stop by, and similar to Steve Jobs, he'd say, "Yo, what are you working on?" Well, you knew that in order to give an answer that would please Reagan, you had to show him that you were working on one of a few core issues, such as beating the communists, lowering taxes, reducing the size of federal government. Anybody from that era remembers what the four or five key pillars of Reaganism were. With Bush, well, other than reacting to events, they weren't really sure what his program was. So they experienced a level of frustration knowing if what they were doing was actually what they were supposed to be doing. With Reagan, it was clear. If somebody asked you that question, you knew what to link it to. With Bush, yeah, who knows? And on a day-to-day, and in terms of building your own career and developing your own track record, you've got to know where the track is and be riding it in order to develop a track record.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, I found that very interesting when I read that.
Well, people are they're following that. Like, what's that person up to, and can they see? And can they see? And that's a level. Then it brings a level of trust. Elliot Jack's psychiatric research around levels of complex thinking and how to organize around that was revolutionary and so politically incorrect it was not adopted. But I mean, a lot of people do adopt it. But most people don't know about it. But it was like, you know, humans each have a certain level of complex thinking, and it's either you got it or you don't. The level you're on.
Yeah.
It violates all personal development, and everybody's got potential, and everybody can think outside the box. And basically, when you look at the neurological research, that's all bullshit. I mean,
oh my God.
Everybody's where you should be, and you can perform where you should be. But it's hard to take someone with a low level of complex thinking that could run a 1-week plan very well and say, now I want you to run a 5-year plan for the future of our business. And their eyes glaze over. And I made this mistake more than once when I brought in teams to, you know, scale the IP that we have been developing, and they were just clueless. And I didn't realize I was violating my own research because I had to tell them what to do. And then they couldn't understand how to do it. And that was the problem. I did bring on one person, and all of a sudden she starts telling me what to do. She's like, you got all these areas in, but this isn't scalable. And this is, so we got to do that. And all of a sudden I'm sitting there like, oh my God, that's what I've been looking for. You know, I want somebody, I got to tell them how to do their job. I just hired the wrong person, you know? So I think, leadership is not only providing, as you were describing, something for people to follow, but also being able to put people in those roles where they can join and follow. And in other words, it's hard when you leave the dock and you have to be below deck all the time, telling people how to clean cannons and row the boat or something.
Yeah. I'll tell you, there are two in-the-box thinkers I really appreciate. Those are my cats.
Okay, yes.
And anybody who has cats knows that you really want them to be in-the-box thinkers, if you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. But outside of that, to your point, not everybody is designed to be an out-of-the-box thinker. Right. You know, as I, you know, one of the things I see sometimes in the entrepreneurial world is people saying, How could you stand going and sitting in a cubicle for 8 hours a day and working on spreadsheets? You know, there are people out there who crave that. And that is their intersection of their brilliance and their passion. Their sense of value, worth, making a difference, making the world a better place by being part of it and by their contributions to it is in managing the living hell out of those spreadsheets. And, you know, we need those people.
Exactly.
So there are some folks you do not want to disturb while they're doing their best work. And not everybody was designed to be Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, or Elon Musk. But at the same time, those three guys would be nowhere without the people who know how to run the spreadsheets.
And we need people at all levels. That's the whole point. It gets back to your promotion piece. I mean, if we promoted everybody to be a vice president, we have nobody actually doing real work with customers.
And yeah.
It's like you need more people delivering value at levels that make an impact versus people that are at the top thinking. Because if our civilization just had a lot of thinkers, we'd have starved because nobody's collecting food.
Right. Yeah.
You know, on the other hand, if you have a lot of people that are just dealing with the meaningful, high impact day to day level stuff, but not someone setting direction, you know, then you probably won't make a lot of progress in terms of civilization and how to allocate resources properly and how to grow and develop. So it needs to be a partnership. But at the top, you only need a few people doing the higher level thinking. Most people should be actually engaging in meaningful, productive work.
Yeah. And I think that, to me, one of the opportunities we have is to remove the stigma from that.
Yes.
There's nothing wrong with productive work. Productive work is good. I love productive work myself. And, you know, let's look at some of these folks I mentioned. And I'm going to single out Bill Gates and Elon Musk, two out of the three I mentioned. I brought up those three names for a reason. With Bill Gates and also with Elon, you'll notice they go through a pattern when they acquire companies. When they first acquire the company or found the company, for a brief period of time, they personally will lead it. If it's an acquisition, they'll tear the whole model down and rebuild it in their own image. If it's something new, they'll build it from the ground up using guerrilla tactics. Once they got the thing up and running, they step aside and they bring in a new CEO.
Mm-hmm.
The reason being is they are the tinkerers. Bill Gates wanted out of the CEO seat at Microsoft because he wanted to play with the software development. We saw with Twitter just very recently, Elon was only CEO of Twitter for a few months before he brought in somebody else, because where his greatest contribution to Twitter is, A, he came in and completely reformed it and got things moving in the direction he wanted to go, and now he just likes playing with code.
Yeah.
I mean, he is a guy who will sit in front of a computer for 20 hours and solve one piece of code. And it was the same when he put that same level of focus during his time as the active executive of Tesla. He would take a mat out and sleep on a production floor. Mm-hmm. That's how close to the action he was. Another thing that's not all that well known about him is I believe he might own a mansion somewhere. I'm not sure, but I don't think he lives there. It is pretty well known that he owns some $35,000 house in Texas because he has to legally live somewhere for legal purposes. But his actual residences are little cubicles he has at the executive offices of each of his companies. And if he's not there, he's staying in hotels or crashing on his friends' couches. Because he has no mansion need. What he needs is to be close to the action wherever he is at any given time. And that goes to something that I think impacts in a way how we view leadership and management is prestige. So for some people, the idea of prestige is, well, now that I've reached a certain point, I have to have a bigger house or I'm not really successful, or I have to have a nicer car or I'm not really successful. And for those who want to argue that point, I'll point out Bill Gates' Ford Escort that he drove for all those years.
Yeah. I mean, gets back to the point, being lead dog sucks. You got to really want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so in the cases we've just discussed here, these are folks who enjoy being at the head of the pack, but it's, you have to look at what pack they're actually leading and what their contribution to the pack really is. It's not necessarily being the figurehead.
Right.
Another term that we see for these types of innovators and executives who then bring on somebody else to actually be the CEO are, you can view them as the types who own the company. Their influence controls the company, but they need adult supervision. So they bring in a, they bring in somebody to babysit them. I mean, because when you look at somebody like Elon Musk, does the word discipline come to mind?
Discipline and creativity. I mean, there's a...
Bingo. You went where I was going with this. Not the traditional term of discipline, like I use task lists. I show up promptly on time. I work 10 hours a day. I make sure to get my workout in. I follow all these procedures. I turn in my paperwork on at a time. Not that type of discipline. He has a different type of discipline.
Yes.
Yeah. And to me, that goes back to what we were discussing earlier, is understanding where people's brilliance and passion really are and making sure they're in the right place in the dog pack.
Yeah.
So how does, we're coming fairly close to the end here, we may be jumping a little bit ahead, so you may need to back up on me a little bit here. You mentioned a leader becoming a samurai. So how do they do that in order to enhance their personal leadership, enhance their career?
When we get at picking up organizational speed, we find that what's stopping organizations from executing quickly and being decisive is usually ego and power and fear-based behaviors, which is why we see when we do our studies, we find that employees, executives, middle managers will say that somewhere between 20 to 80%, but the average is around 50% of people's time in the business are in dysfunctional behaviors, silos, cliques, withholding information, power. You go through the whole political spectrum of what humans do, and a lot of that is occurring. And so we went to find out how to get speed going. And it was the ancient manuscript. We began testing how to die properly as a technique for speed. And it worked. And it worked so well that we just, so when I published the Code of the Executive, that was just the beginning. It was back in the 90s. But then at Hopkins, I began to get connected with a lot of brilliant people. And it turns out it's very biologically, explainable, because our ego is there for genetic warfare. And genetic warfare, we're pretty successful at, because we've got a species still alive. Most species are extinct, but the species that are still alive are selfish. And that's why selfishness is a great strategy. But it gets in the way for organizational performance. So getting rid of selfishness means you have to detach the ego's imprint, which is with us since birth, which is why most children are selfish. And the way to unhook that I think the samurai stumbled onto, is detach the reason for being selfish, detach the reason for survivability and genetic warfare. And that was in imagining that you have to die and accepting your death. At that point, then things emerge throughout history with these types of teams, and today with companies, even the ones that we've worked with to test this, is they achieved the levels of bravery and honor. And I thought, wow, this should be the first class in leadership training. It's how to die properly, so that we can invoke bravery and honor in our people versus the normal selfish Dilbert level or the office level behaviors that we all enjoy watching, because it's the world we live in.
Yeah. And
so I think becoming samurai was a matter of just remembering that someday we must die, so that what they call the evil spirit, but what we now call the ego, unhooks its grip, and we can focus with more bravery and honor, and also open ourselves up to suffering and sacrifice. Another two things that we fail to teach in our business schools is, can we get people to suffer and sacrifice with us? Because if you got those elements, that's how you create these great companies. As you were describing, people sleeping on the floor, people being close to the action. I mean, you get people around you that are willing to suffer and sacrifice with you for a greater cause. And they're coming from a space of bravery and honor. That's an unstoppable team. You know what I mean? It's not, that's, you get this whole happy employee movement going on. I'm all for, you know, happy employees, but I'll put a team up that has bravery and honor and they're willing to suffer and sacrifice against a happy employee movement any day, because I think they'll outrun them. I think they'll outmaneuver them. I think their products will be more innovative. I think their customer service will be superior. I think, you know, I just think it's a, from what I've seen in industry, it seems to be a better way to lead.
Yeah. And to me, that comes down to alignment and being at your intersection of your brilliance and your passion, because you'll suffer for what you really want. You'll suffer for what is viscerally authentic to you, not so much for something that isn't.
Yeah, right. So in your previous role, in your previous job, where you said you had, you know, we're going through this this discovery and just showing up for work, obviously they failed to do that with you.
I gave them 4 years and all they did was shove org charts in my face and say, see how low you are on this org chart? Why are you opening your mouth? How much time am I going to spend beating my fist on a brick wall before I get sick of bleeding? So I actually put myself through pain, and all I got was, well, we're going to hurt you some more. I mean, yeah, I got little crumbs thrown at me every now and then, but I never really, except for two of my supervisors, I never really felt that I was all that appreciated. I felt more under attack, like somehow my very existence was offending the entire organization. Well, you know, how long is somebody going to put up with that? And once I got to the point of quiet quitting, when it came time for the struggle and sacrifice, where do you think I was going to be?
Right, exactly.
My day's off at 4:30. Next trolley comes in at 4:37. I want to make it. That's where I was.
Right.
I wasn't there hanging out another 2 hours. They had me for that, and they told me they didn't want it.
Yeah.
So I don't care if somebody there is listening to this right now, and if this is something that they believe or don't believe or want to argue about, that's fine. But as I see it, they chose mediocrity. And I'll stick by that. Hey, if they have a different version of the story, then that's their different version of the story. But you know, the thing that I've learned over time, and it took me a while to get here, is that other people's stories about you are not your story. So this has been really, really, really interesting. I love these types of mastermind dives. So one final question is, if anybody here is in a leadership or management position or aspires to be, what is one thing that you, Don, would urge them to do or consider as soon as they finish streaming this episode, other than, of course, buying your book?
Well, I've got several books out there. I would say, you know, if you're going to do anything and you want to keep up on the research, just go to the website, because you may not need the book. Maybe you just need an idea to move forward. That's sagaleadership.com, by the way.
Yeah, and I was going to say that in a moment, but it's okay for you to jump the gun.
Yeah, sure. I just told Vikings, you know, the saga leadership. And I think this question is to look at, you know, why do you want to be a leader? I mean, you know, what's behind all that? But if you do choose to be a leader and you realize that, hey, it's not going to be always a lot of fun, and I may have to be the lead dog running into a collision, but I got to, you know, that's my role. Is, am I willing to do the suffering and sacrifice to become a leader and to you know, take the risks and to develop myself? Because that's the level of commitment. And I think when I see the great CEOs I work with, they're always the ones that are questioning themselves. You know, what am I missing? Or what's the next performance gap I have to leave? Or how do I improve? And they're really open. Yeah. They're very coaching. We do not take on clients that already know everything. because they are totally unable to be helped.
Yeah, you know, it's, I remember when I was in my 30s and I finally found out I didn't know everything. And, you know, the advice that we urge parents to give their teenagers is son, daughter, move out quick while you still know it all.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
You have the edge right now. Yeah, right. And you know, we make jokes about that, but I think part of that is just that the human brain does not develop on an arbitrary timetable. We call somebody an adult at either 18 or 21, depending on how you define that here in the United States, but there's actually, they still have a ways to go before their brain reaches maturity.
Yeah.
And I don't think we as a society do enough of that. So we, so for example, we look at, oh, you're 24 years old and you haven't moved out of your parents' house yet. And we say that like that's a bad thing. What if it's not a bad thing? I didn't leave my parents' house until I was 27. Although I can tell you that part of the reason I stayed as long as I did is because from the time I was 23, I had a full-time job and was pursuing an MBA full-time. And then as soon as I finished the MBA, I still had the full-time job, got diagonally promoted in it, but I quickly got bit by the entrepreneurial bug. So I spent a further 2 years working on turning this side gig into a sustainable business. And I didn't know back then what I know now. Instead of 2 years, it could have been 6 months. I get that now, but you know, and anyway, even if somebody had told me that, who was I to listen? Because I knew everything at the time, remember? So some folks may not be ready to make that transition yet, but I can tell you the moment that I had that business up and running on its own and I was drawing my my living expenses off of it, I was out of there in about 3 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of when the individual is truly ready to take that next step. And then, and then we don't ask, well, what if the parents need you? Because then they make the argument that, you know, your parents do so much for you growing up. And I think you mentioned you have kids too, if I'm correct. And, you know, you gave so much to them. You were their guide, their mentor, their leader, their protector. And what if they want to stick around and give back?
Mm-hmm.
So many parents wonder when their kids are going to call. And then other parents are blessed with kids that don't want to leave because they want to give back. Who are we to discourage that? I know that's a good question to sit with. So I'll break the silence there. Mm-hmm. All right. So with that, again, I'm going to encourage all of our listeners. You do want to visit Dawn's website. It's sagaleadership.com. I might have mispronounced that at first. It's sagaleadership.com. And you can find some of Dawn's speeches. You can find his books. You can find the blog he's mentioned a couple times. I've looked at it and I've seen a few articles. The one about the butterfly effect was particularly interesting to me, but go ahead and check that out. And you may find some further inspiration. And if you want to go ahead and speak with Dawn, reach out to him. His contact information is there. Follow him on social media. His links are right there. I believe they're right underneath his bio. And tell him the Business Creators Radio Show sent you. I love when people get that joyous feeling of knowing that they connected with somebody. So with that, Dawn Schmincke, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been an honor and, believe me, an education.
Hey, well, thank you too. I've enjoyed it.
We trust you enjoyed today's episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. Check out our previous and upcoming episodes on our website at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. While you're there, be sure to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. Until next time, have a great day. Take care.